April, my eyes are going, 24th, 1998. On the calendar today, we have House Bill 389, and which is the exemption from overtime for airline employees. And then we also have House Bill 486, the Alaska Security Act revisions. 477 is withdrawn. First, we're going to take up House Bill 389.
Quorum.
Oh, yes. I said corrected. Thank you very much. For the record, present are Chairman Roker, Vice Chairman Codrey, Representative Hudson, and Representative Sanders. We do have a quorum to conduct business. As indicated, the House Bill 477, the Alaska Common Ownership Act, will not be taken up today. We'll have two bills on the calendar. And with that, we would like to take up House Bill 389. Representative Codrey, sir.
Yeah, I'm the sponsor of 389. House Bill 389 was introduced at the request of an ad hoc group of employees from United Airlines. And in fact, one of the employees was a neighbor of mine. Since its introduction, support has broadened to include the entire commercial airline industry in Alaska. The Alaska Air Carriers Association, its individual constituent members and their employees are asking the legislature to pass this legislation. Both management and employees support it. House Bill 389 is intended to allow airline employees to trade work days with each other without invoking overtime or pay requirements. Under strict interpretation of the current statute, a substitute employee who works a shift with another for another employee must be paid overtime if the substitute employee already worked 8 hours in the same work day or 40 hours in the same work week. Consequently, shift trading can only occur when the substitute employee has a day off from his or her regular shift. This situation narrows the available pool of substitute workers and makes it impossible or very difficult to trade shifts in the least. Many employees like to, say, in the salmon season, take a Friday off or something like that to make a long weekend. And this, I think it's been done quite a lot in the past, but the airline employees in Alaska are vexed under Alaska's statute 23.10.160 because we are the only state in the, in the United States that has a daily overtime requirement. This bill gives Alaska's employees of airlines the same treatment as their counterparts in 49 other states. Shift trading among employees in the airline industry is a very common practice. Usually it is done informally with sort of with a tactic approval of the employer. House Bill 389 would legitimize the practice that has become the custom of the industry. Without it, employee airlines would violate the law if they allow their employees to trade shifts. Organized labor would prefer the status quo, I'm sure, but they have indicated that they'll work with us on this bill. They're against any weakening of the overtime pay requirements and statutes. There's no problem with the status quo as long as the Department of Labor doesn't enforce statutes. However, neither the legislature nor the governor should be a party to any practice that condones arbitrary enforcement. We must tell the employees of the Alaska or the airline industry in Alaska that, and we must provide a mechanism for them to do it legally I hope that this legislature or this bill will find a way to make that happen. That concludes my opening statement, and I have asked Marco, my staff, if there's any other questions about the bill. I'm a little under the weather today, but we'll make it.
Well, thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. We're glad to have you here and appreciate your presentation. With that, we'd like to go on the teleconference. There's a number of people signed up for that, and I'd like to take that testimony. We do have a sign-up sheet here where Mr. Perkins signed it. Is anybody else that's in the audience that wanted to testify on this bill today? I'll have the aide have you sign up there, and we'll take your testimony and make sure you do that. With that, we'd like to go to Anchorage and hear from Douglas Orcutt. For the record today, try to hold your testimony down to two, no more than 3 minutes. Please identify yourself by name and your affiliation, please, and your phone number if you're available. Mr. Orcutt, sir.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, yeah. Sir.
Yes, my name is Douglas Orcutt. I work for Alaska Airlines. I also am the vice president for the IAM union representing Alaska Airlines employees out of District 143 in Seattle. And I have a prepared statement here. I've worked for Alaska Airlines for 23 years. I've enjoyed the ability to trade days and shifts off during the course of my employment, both in Seattle and in Anchorage. The practice of trading days off or shifts by employees of Alaska Airlines has been in effect for over 30 years. Alaska Airlines, like other airlines in the industry, operates 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Voluntary day and shift trading among employees is a long-standing airline industry practice, which allows an employee to obtain additional time off from work to address personal and professional needs, which would otherwise be unavailable to them. These needs can range from time off not covered by a working agreement and a relative's funeral to the ability to spend quality time with family when work and school schedules conflict, or to perform charitable work in the community and to obtain additional education. The International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, the IAM, currently represents the mechanic and related MRP employees, as well as the clerical office and passenger service COPS employees under separate contracts with Alaska Airlines. As I mentioned earlier, I have been elected and currently serve as an IAM District 143 Vice President for the union at Alaska Airlines and help administer and enforce both contracts throughout the Alaska system. Although the MRP agreement is silent, the practice of trading days off or shifts has always been allowed and does not and was never intended to jeopardize overtime rules or pay for that work group. Moreover, the current working agreement between Alaska Airlines and the IAM for the clerical office passenger service employees does have negotiated contract language under its Article 5, Hours of Service, Paragraph F, page 14, which states, employees in the same classification and work group may participate in the trade of days off or shift with their manager's approval 48 hours in advance. I emphasize, employees shall be compensated as if they remained on their original days off and shifts. When employees trade days off or shifts, they will be considered for pay purposes to have remained in their scheduled days off and or shifts. The mechanic and related employee group is currently in contract negotiation with Alaska Airlines, and with support from the carrier, is seeking to adopt contract language identical to the COPS agreement. I have reviewed House Bill 389 and would offer only the following suggestion. The Act should include further language under paragraph D, which would clarify when employees trade days off or shifts that they will be considered for pay purposes to have remained in their scheduled days off or shifts, as it is described in the COPS working agreement, which I have read. As an employee and a union representative with Alaska Airlines, I certainly support House Bill 389 because it maximizes schedule flexibility for employees while minimizing administrative scheduling for management and provides a positive voluntary benefit to all employees. If any member of the House committee or other interested parties in the labor community should desire further information regarding our position on this pending legislation, please do not hesitate to contact me, Douglas Orcutt, at my home office in Anchorage at 907-561-0436, or Tom Gibbs, General Chairman, Air Transport District 143, Seattle, Washington, at 1-800-248-0143. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Get those numbers, yeah. Mr. Orcutt, could you repeat both those phone numbers, please? Sir?
Again, my phone number in Anchorage here is 907-561-0436. Tom Gibbs, the General Chairman for Alaska Airlines in Seattle, Washington. His phone number is 1-800-248-0143.
Are there questions, Mr. Orcutt?
Do I have any questions?
No, I'm asking the committee if there's any questions of you, sir. Mr. Orcutt, this is the chairman. Representative Hudson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Orcutt, you indicated that this has been a practice for 30 years. Is that correct?
Yeah, I talked to my boss, who's my general chairman in Seattle, and he said it's been in effect for at least 30 years, probably longer. Alaska Airlines has had a contract with the IAM since 1958.
If it's been working for 30 years, why do we need to change it?
Well, just like I agree with the sponsor of the bill, perhaps we need to legitimize this practice in the state of Alaska.
Representative Cowdery.
Yeah, yeah. As I understand, even though it's been in existence, it could lead to the employer facing a lawsuit, a class action lawsuit, or something for that time, some sort of a legal problem, if they endorse this as it stands now. Am I correct?
Yes, I think I'm in agreement with that. Although there's never been any claims from any employees on Alaska Airlines. I talked to the Special Assistant Commissioner Dwight Perkins here the other day on the phone, and he indicated that they have never received any complaints from Alaska Airlines.
But I understand, but that's not to say some ambitious lawyer could come around and offer some employees money and to enter into a suit.
Oh, yeah, I'm not saying that couldn't happen. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I know that.
Yeah, I'm in favor of the bill.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right.
Mr. Orcutt, this is the chairman.
Yeah.
Have you had any communications with the AFL-CIO or the Teamsters
No, I have not.
I would recommend that you do so and try to get them behind your union here. It's been our experience that the organized labor takes a jaundiced eye at amending this particular provision of the statute, so I recommend that you get those chaps on your side where they belong as a pro-worker group. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
One moment. The gentleman here, do you guys have to get back to work, or you got to? Okay, no problem. Very good.
What shifts?
Shift change, all right. Did you trade shifts?
They trade shifts.
Right. Next, we'd like to go to Michelle Buckmaster, please.
Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
We got you.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, ma'am.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Michelle Buckmaster. I've been with United Airlines for 10 years. And my phone number, if you want to contact me, is 907-344-5878. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Michelle Buckmaster. I'm a customer service representative for United Airlines in Anchorage, Alaska. Before I begin, I'd like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to give my testimony. Yesterday, I faxed you several pages of text, including a revised copy of House Bill 389 and a copy of a similar bill that was passed recently in Washington State. In May 1997, United Airlines informed employees in Alaska that because of the state labor laws in our state, the trade policy and company regulations would no longer pertain to us. This trade policy is a significant benefit to us as employees, as well as all airline employees in Alaska. In an industry that spends 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, in promoting and supporting the economic growth of our state through tourism, conventions, sporting events, and numerous other activities, the trade policy is a valuable benefit and tool to its employees who would otherwise miss out on precious time with family, observance of religious holidays, educational opportunities, summer vacations, and extra time for those who require it. In an industry where competition is always a priority, we have come together to make a change that will benefit and create a win-win situation for all airline employees. Over the past year, employees from several air carriers have worked together to encourage the implementation of this bill. As you are aware from the numerous phone calls and letters from concerned airline employees, there has been a great deal of grassroots support for this legislation. In closing, we understand and respect the labor laws that are here to protect us. However, this particular law, which may be a protection in your eyes, has eliminated a benefit in ours. Therefore, I'm here on behalf of these employees to request the amendment we have brought before you not only be passed, but be passed in a timely manner so that this valuable benefit may be re-implemented as soon as possible. And again, thank you for your time.
Any questions, Mr. Buckmaster? Representative Gunner.
Yeah, I'd just like to let the committee know that Michelle was the first that brought this problem to me, and she's did a lot of work on this, and gathering signatures and other employees. that have some concern.
Oh, and for the record, Representative Kadri, the chairman worked as a passenger service agent for Alaska Airlines, the Anchorage International Airport, 34 years ago, and we were doing it then. So I can verify that it's beyond 30 years myself personally. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we'd like to hear from Daniel Schmitty, is it?
Actually, it's Daniel Smith, S-M-I-T-H.
It's not spelled right here, Mr. Smith. My apologies, and please give us your testimony and identify yourself and your affiliation.
My name is Daniel Smith. I'm an employee with Alaska Airlines, or United Airlines here in Alaska. And I would just like to reiterate what Mr. Orchid and Michelle Buckmaster said somewhat more eloquently than I, that this trade policy is an important tool to help out the employees. And yeah, like they said, it is almost an industry standard. It's only here in Alaska that our hands are tied and that we're having a problem with this trading policy. That's really all I have to say. My name is Dan Smith. If you'd like to contact me, my number is 907-333-1008. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. I appreciate that. Next, we go to Michael Broadway, sir.
Yeah, I'm Michael Broadway. I work for United Airlines. I'm just here to show my support for basically what the people before me have said. To only reiterate what they said, that it's basically an airline industry standard. It's just we're just been tied in Alaska. We can't go on with what's happening system-wide throughout United.
Mm-hmm.
And just make a more friendly work environment, which creates better jobs. And that's pretty much it. Thank you.
That's it.
Very good, sir. Thank you very much, Mr. Bradley. Any questions? Mano, you're in Anchorage?
I am, Mr. Chairman.
Could you have time to start? I'd like to get some testimony from Dwight before we have you
talk. I have plenty of time, Mr. Chairman. For you, the world.
Thank you, Mr. President, Mr. Fry. With that, we'd like to take some testimony from the gentleman here in Juneau, Mr. David Atherns, is it, sir?
Athern, yes, sir.
Yeah. Could you please come up and identify yourself and give us your testimony, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is David Athern. I am an employee of Alaska Airlines. I've been here in Juneau for 22 years. My airline career extends back 35 years, and I would like to state that trade policy was in effect back in the dark ages of the industry also. If anything, it's become more of an integral part of the business, as it were, among the employee groups. On a daily basis, in my work group, there's probably 30 employees on the various shifts throughout the 24-hour time period, and about that number in the COPS group, I being in the MRP, mechanic and related, and the COPS people, they're the ones at the ticket counter, the freight office, and what have you. I individually maintain a trade book to keep track of who's on first, etc. And there is anywhere from 5 to 10 or a dozen daily people that are very dependent upon a good, viable day trade policy to have time off available for a variety of reasons, vacation, personal time, etc. This is such an ingrained part of the way we do business out at Alaska Airlines that there's no way that I can conceive that we could operate unless we had the policy like this in effect. There is one provision in the bill which I had a question about, but my associate will bring that up. It has to do with the the accountability of the time. But I'll let Chris take that into effect. I want to thank you for allowing us to speak here. This was very short notice for both of us. We were kind of torn away from work and asked to come down here today. But I would like to see this this bill passed. I think that it needs to be cut in stone. We do have it in one half of our work group, as Mr. Orcutt had mentioned. We do not have that language in our contract, however, and we'd like to see that. Anyway, thank you for your time.
Questions? Yes. Representative Cotter, sir.
Yes. When it comes time to trade days off, do you just do it between your individuals, or do you work through management, or how does that normally, as your experiences have been? If you
We have what we call a lead ramp service or lead passenger service that is the representative of management for these purposes. The person desiring a trade initiates the paperwork between themselves with the approval of whoever happens to be the straw boss of their work group that day. And then it's entered into a trade log, so when shifts change, the new lead coming on duty can just simply look at a piece of paper and say, Joe for Sam on such and such a shift, and know who's going to be there.
So if you make an agreement to trade with, say, your partner, and you hold up your part of the agreement, and then your partner doesn't fill his, what happens then? Are you looked upon management to do that, to step in and pay you for that?
Then that becomes a, if you've held up your end of the bargain and someone, the person that had agreed to trade with you did not show up, you're not going to be held accountable for that because you had a viable trade established with them. If the other person spaced it out or called in sick or whatever, you're not held responsible for that. It would be considered a leave, an authorized leave of absence for you.
But so if you make a trade, this doesn't show up on your paycheck. It's just in the operation records. Is that?
It is. There is record made of it. There's a provision on our time card that you circle the day. Say you took Tuesday. It says trade day worked. You would circle that, or trade day off. You would circle that.
So you have printed time cards.
Yes,
that
we do.
That with this is it's so common that you put a you have time cards that indicate that possibility.
Yeah, it's an innovation that came 8-10 years ago. It didn't always have them on the time card, but for accountability purposes, we have them now.
Thank you.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So Dave, we just heard in the last testimony that United has essentially put their people on notice that they're no longer going to do this because of the law. Has Alaska Airlines notified you that they would not continue the current practice?
The current trade practice?
Yes.
No, sir, they have not.
Thank you.
No, they're pretty much on the same page with us on this, I think.
That's all.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Questions, let Marco.
Mr. Chris Monigal, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I'm the past president here the last 5 years. My name is Chris Monigal of Local 2263. Which is the local that covers all of Southeast for Alaska Airlines, the ramp maintenance divisions. I think that what we're looking for here is protection for things to remain the same. The United situation has certainly given us a scare, taking away our trade benefits. In my situation, I'll give you a perfect example of how I use the trades. People rely on them on a daily basis, and I coach Little League Baseball. In 17 years I've been with the carrier, I haven't been able to pull Saturdays off. Saturdays, of course, are game days for Little League. So it's very well known in May and in June of every year I'll be trading my Saturdays so I can coach my Little League team. And I usually give them to the college kids who come back, and they pick up the extra money, and I get the day off. And so pretty typically in the summertime, people use them to pick up an extra day on a weekend to go fishing. I think that example was used. Miss just, we, Dave and I just got back from the floor at work, and I know the work group out there feels very strongly about this issue, and they're waiting to hear. I've got a time card here that I brought in, and we talked about the trade day. They actually have a little column here, trade days worked, and it shows that Monday through Friday. I can
pass it around.
Pass around to you. It's so common that it's on every time card for every employee, and I wanted to say that when you do trade, it's always at a regular, just straight time rate. There's never, I guess, any advantage to stockpile overtime or to violate any state laws regarding the use of or accumulation of overtime. So I see it as nothing but a benefit, and would strongly favor the bill.
Big copy.
Questions of Mr. Mongo?
I do, Mr. Chairman. You say it's a common thing, but on the same token, your airline hasn't sent notice. But we had, I think I had communication with Alaska Airline, well, with the airline industry as a whole. They felt, the management felt that if we didn't, something similar to this bill happened, that it could be selectively enforced to, and that was their concern. It wasn't that the airline industry, as you said, and as the testimony showed, that they're all in favor of this. They just wanted to have it so they don't get something stacked up on them and then they have to defend it.
Right. That was, I would agree.
Mr. Monaco. There's other, Alaska's the largest carrier here in Genia there, but there's other small commuter type air taxis and other scheduled carriers here. Are those folks members of any unions here, or are they generally non-union personnel?
To my knowledge, I think most of the small carriers are non-union. I'm pretty
sure. How many people do you think work on the ramps and as passenger service agents or would be covered under this bill with your firm, work in those same capacities for all the other kind of carriers and anchorages that are not union members?
For the other carriers?
Yeah, just kind of roughly. We're talking about 20, 30 people, maybe 50 or 100. I don't know. What are we talking about?
I'd be very small compared to, of course, Alaska. Any ideas, Dave, on
non-union, Mark?
Altogether.
Gross.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's several dozen, probably.
Yeah,
no more.
No more than probably less than cumulatively 40 people right around there. I don't know what Wings employs, but they'd probably be the biggest other carrier here in Juneau.
And would that include the pilots too?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any further questions or responding? I'd like to thank you, gentlemen, for coming down and taking your time for your day. Please appreciate it. Really appreciate that.
We'll get your card right back to you.
Okay.
Okay. That's his actual card for today. He's not going to get paid. You know.
Give it back to him. We're just taking copies.
No, I'll give it back to him.
Yeah, but okay. I had Peter take the copies.
Yeah, don't be losing that card.
Yeah.
We don't want our witnesses complaining about.
Lose 40 hours right there, huh?
We got lots of friends all the time.
With that, I'd like to hear from Mr. Fry in Anchorage, sir. Mano, are you available, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Mano Fry, and I'm the president of the Alaska AFL-CIO. And I do appreciate your comments and questions. And I mean this sincerely. You have, I believe, become enlightened about some of our concerns and issues regarding overtime and wage and hour laws, and I appreciate you and your committee members' concern. As you know, we're very reluctant when there are efforts to change the wage and hour laws. I mean, through the last 2 years, the last two legislative sessions, we've had many opportunities to discuss with you and your committee members our concern in changing the law to downgrade what are strong, there are no doubts about it, there are strong overtime laws and wage and hour laws in this state, and we think that that's good. We don't feel it's a negative. I think it's good for the workers of this state to know that they're, if they work overtime, they're going to get paid overtime, and generally it amounts to employers scheduling those employees off rather than pay the overtime, which really was originally the very intent of having overtime, is to allow people more time with their families and to do things that they'd rather do than necessarily be working even at an overtime rate. Having said that, I take very seriously your questions with regard to Doug's testimony. We have not spoken about this until just prior to the hearing, and it is very rare that the state AFL-CIO is in opposition to a bill supported strongly by one of its affiliates. But that is the case today. We do oppose the bill, but let me assure you that we will, when we push the button and listen today to the rest of the testimony, the Machinist Union and the AFL-CIO will schedule a meeting to sit down and discuss this, see if there are ways that would provide some reassurances that we might feel necessary, and if we can make the bill palatable, we would change our position, and I will try to set up a meeting as quickly as we can, depending on our schedules. Maybe Doug could trade a day off or so, and we could do it earlier. But Mr. Chairman, let me tell you that we will try to schedule a meeting so that we can see if there's not a way to reach a middle ground on this, because it is a very uncomfortable position, and especially hearing the testimony, something that's gone on. Representative Cowdery, you are right. Something that's gone on for as long as this has, it's ripe for some rascal attorney to try to make a case out of it, and I'd do almost anything to try to prevent that.
Yeah.
Representative Cowdery.
Yeah, it's you know, it's not the intention to, my intention, or I don't think the employees who asked for this, to do any downgrading of organized labor. I think but it's something that we got to work out some way, and I'd be glad to help work with you any way we can to something that happens anyway to make this so it's not a some sort of a selective enforcement, if that might happen, or so that they can't come back in days past after this and go back on a class action lawsuit that might really get out of control. That's what I hope to do.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cowdery, I agree with that, and I will try to set up a meeting here with the machinist group to see if we can't reach some method of reaching something that we can support.
Thank you. And also, while you're meeting, I'd appreciate any help you can do on the Anchorage Airport.
Hey, I stand ready to help.
Jump in there.
You've heard me testify that one.
Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Fry, I mean, you wouldn't be considering the 13th. All right. Mr. Fry, you wouldn't be considering the 13th of May for a date for that meeting, would you?
No way. No. In fact, we'll compare calendars. Today's Friday, but if Doug can do it early next week, I'm ready to rock and roll.
Because, Mr. Fry, you know, as my constituent, I would not want to do anything to ruffle your feathers, but I think this is an excellent piece of legislation, and I do want to sit corrected and correct my the date I said. I actually worked 31 years ago for Alaska. It was 34 years ago I worked with Northwest Airlines at the Anchorage Airport, and I am very familiar with this situation from my own personal experience, and this is a long-standing traditional practice. And it's so pro-worker, I would not even want to have any Any idea that you, as a chief representative of organized labor in this state, would stand in the way of the workers of this state? I mean, I just cannot conceive of that. I mean, it's beyond my understanding.
Mr. Chairman, I am curious, how come you downgraded yourself and left the airline industry represented by a good, strong union in the real estate business? I can't believe it.
I was a college boy and stuff at the end of that. I just got out of the Army and I started working in the airline business. And then I left Alaska Airlines. I took a leave of absence and took a opened my first business, the Birdhouse.
I like that place.
Yeah, and then I never went back, you know. But
to the Birdhouse?
No, to the last one. I went back to the Birdhouse a lot, but I sold that and went back to college, right? You know, Mr. Representative Hudson.
Mr. Chairman, I guess it's important for me to declare a conflict. My son is a pilot in Anchorage, captain of his own plane, and he flies commercially, so he definitely will be implicated by this. And his wife, my daughter-in-law, is an airline stewardess. She works as a host in the airplane. So I do have a conflict. And
sorry.
I need for the record to declare that, sir.
Not a problem. We do have another witness here.
Yeah, I'd just like to ask Mano, if you could come up with a date certain when for your recommendation for this.
What do you got going on Monday or Tuesday? About Monday afternoon, Mr. Chairman, we'll be meeting, and I'll try to get back to you as quickly as possible, either late Monday or early Tuesday.
Thank you. This is Representative Cowdery. Thank you.
Right. In closing, Mr. Fry, I think that the committee would look upon kindly your recommendations to the department not to try to enforce this or anything else until this is resolved.
I absolutely would go on record supporting that, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, we would not want to see any kind of conflict rise up on the situation. You bet.
Would you make the other step and put that in writing to United Airlines?
Sure. Who?
President.
You can talk to the Miss Buckmaster there. She's still there. She'll tell you. With that, we'd like to hear from Mr. Perkins, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dwight Perkins, Special Assistant to Commissioner Cashin at the Department of Labor. A lot of good testimony today. It seems as we get more and more into time with this committee, Mr. Chairman, there's a lot of similarities between you and Commissioner Cashin. You know, he started his career just down the street here for Ellis Air, where the Merchants Wharf hangar is now, as an A&P mechanic, and found out that he didn't like working around that water and over the water and on those planes, and got into electrical business like your father. But anyway, back to the legislation. You know, we've had some discussion. I did with Mr. Orcutt, the representative from the International Machinists Association, just recently. I would like to just comment briefly on some of the on the sponsor's statement about the other 49 states. And in all due respect to the sponsor, I believe the research on that is a little bit off. Just the other day, I received from the state of Hawaii notice that there is legislation going through similar to this there. Washington State just this past year adopted legislation similar to the legislation before you. I think it's I'm not sure how many states have it, but I know it's not all 49 other states, and Alaska is not the only state that does not allow this. That's not to say that maybe we shouldn't, but for the record, I think we just need to clear that up just a little bit. There's a few things that were said. United Airlines, and it was United Airlines, by the way, in Hawaii that's pushing this legislation. And based on testimony that was made by a couple of United Airlines employees, I'm sorry that it sounds to me like the employer is getting this whipped up to a frenzy that if the threatening the employees, if you don't take care of it, we're not going to do it. And that's what it sounds like. And I have a little concern with that, that, you know, if that's the case. They've been told, put on notice, that they're not going to allow them to do it anymore if this legislation doesn't get passed. Everybody is on record, and I will be on record, saying this has been a past practice for many, many years. That's absolutely true. The department does not have the money to go out and look for trouble in this type of area. Mr. Orcott did tell me that in the 20-some years that he's worked for Alaska Airlines, there's been one or two people, employees, that have come and asked them about this. After they explain it to them and how it's worked, their opposition was withdrawn. Representative Cowdery, you make a very good point. As Mr. Fry said, there are some out-of-employed attorneys maybe that would like to, like to make some money on this. And there certainly is a concern there. And I would agree with you, Representative Cowdery. Certainly is. I like the department. So having said all that, the department is in the process of trying to reach out. We did with Mr. Gibbs down in Seattle. He got me in touch with Mr. Orcott. I've talked to a couple of friends that work for Alaska Airlines out here. I understand the concern. I've addressed the concern to the commissioner. He does want to work this out. There is language that does touch on, and Mr. Orcott, and I believe maybe a couple of the representatives from Alaska Airlines here, we want to make sure that, and it's in federal statute, to make sure that they aren't, well, for lack of other words, cheated out of their overtime pay when it's due them. Airlines, and I only know Alaska Airlines because I live here in Juneau, and they've been a good airlines to these to the employees of Alaska Airlines here. They have a good track record with their employees. I have several friends that I personally have several friends that work for Alaska Airlines that talk very highly of that particular company. What I would like to see is to have the parties work together. Mr. Fry has committed that he will meet with them on Monday and try to come up with something. We have some legislation. I got facts from Washington State yesterday that I'm trying to go through to see how it would fit to this language. And it might be that we use so that it is clear in other states that we use some language that would fit this and maybe offer a substitute to the bill. But to the legislation. But at this point, I'd like to just say, give us a few days to let us work with the constituent groups, to let us work with the air carriers associations, and try to come back in a timely manner and get this taken care of. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm available for questions.
Let the record show that Representative Ryan's in attendance. Just before I take questions, Mr. Perkins, the chair takes note of your comment about the United Airlines, and I think it's a bit injudicious statement, in as much as my reading of it is that this is a business that is trying to abide by the law, which mm-hmm. your department is mandated to enforce. So to make an allegation that they're fomenting legislation when in fact they're trying to abide by the law is something you need to be taking.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize for any misunderstanding that I might have presented out there. It kind of bothered me that it sounded to me like there may be undue pressure put on the employees for legislation that would cause a hardship for them and quite rightfully give them some stress within their workplace. And I apologize if I misinterpreted or misspoke, Mr. Chairman, or if I offended anybody from United Airlines.
Just to follow up on that, is there anything in the statutes which your department is charged with enforcing to allow for this type of shift swap?
Under current statute, no, Mr. Chairman, there is not. You're absolutely right.
It shows that the people that are interested in this have identified a defect in our statutory construction, and that's the problem. Any Representative Cotter?
Yeah, you know, I if you come up to my office, or maybe we have it here, I don't know, but it's not just been Alaska Airlines, an employee of Alaska Airlines who was a neighbor of mine who rented from a family member of mine. That's how this all started.
Sure.
And then, but also Pin Air, many of the airline people that haven't been mentioned here, the Alaska Air Carriers Association and everything else have endorsed this thing. And I hope you think it's a good bill. I hope that just that we can work it out. That's something that needs to be have the attention and straightened out.
Through the chair, if I may, Representative Roberg, I believe the legislation has merit. I truly believe that it is the employees that are coming forward and wanting this done. In light of what one of the air carriers saw as a deficiency in our legislation, in our statutes regarding wage and overtime laws, it is something that we need to address. The commissioner appreciates the opportunity to work with the Air Carriers Association, with the constituent groups, the employees, with the AFL-CIO, and try to come back in a timely manner to address this concern.
Thank you.
Mr. Perkins, and then Representative Hudson. Mr. Perkins, I'm sure that the commissioner wouldn't want to make himself open to the accusation that he was, not for the working man of the state. I mean, this appears to be the situation. I'm sure that the commissioner would not take kindly to that kind of a charge if it was, leveled against him under these circumstances, I would think.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, what were leveled against the commissioner?
Well, he didn't support the...
I believe he would like to have the opportunity to work with the groups to try to come to a resolution so that it can be moved forward. I think it does, there is some potential, and Mr. Orcutt addressed it in the proposed legislation, there is some potential for abuse. And we'd like to address that with some possibility of some language that is being used around the country that may make it simpler and address the Mr. Orcutt's concern about the overtime provisions.
It wasn't what you said, it's what I said. Representative Hudson.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, Dwight, what strikes me is that the department needs to take a look at this in a general sense, I think. I brought to you my wife's hairdresser's problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really serious, because if I don't behave correctly and really accommodate her, my wife may end up with the wrong color hair or something like that,
or you may have one less hair,
or I may have may not have a wife, or that kind of, or I may not have hair. But at any rate, we really got into this before, and I can see it here and again. And I would really urge the department to try to look at this in a more general sense, because there has to be other sort of general applications like this. It doesn't totally blow away or violate, the working man's right to overtime pay when it's due and payable. So I would just urge you to take a look at that and see if there isn't some way to put that in.
Thank you. Through the chair, thank you, Representative Hubbardson, and I'll carry the message to the commissioner.
Are there any further questions? Representative Cotter.
I believe I was just told that the federal government exempts airline employees from this. Are you aware of that?
Through the chair, Representative Cotter, to some degree,
yeah.
Not across the board. That's something that I have. It's under the Railway Act, and I believe it's U.S. Code 181, and so we are looking at that, and that is what I was referring to as tying into this legislation.
I provide you a copy of the statute as we have.
Thank you.
Mr. Perkins, I would suggest that you do this very expeditiously, or we'll remove the reference to airline business in this thing and move the bill. With that, we'll put this on the table.
It's fast track, Mr. Chairman.
That's right.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I will contact Mr. Fry and Mr. Orcutt, maybe even over the weekend, and see if we can't teleconference, and we can all three get together and have a little chat about this.
I pass this on to the commissioner, too. Thank you very much.
Sure.
With that, we'll hold this bill over, take a momentary at ease, and then we'll take up 486. Next, I'd like to take up 486, the Alaska Security Act. We have here this is the big booklet that Jim announced. Representative Cotter.
No.
Oh, okay. I don't know. Let's see. They weren't very long.
If you wasn't, I was going
okay, Joe Ryan
go to
special.
Bed. But if you think you might, I'll stick around.
This was like a Joe Ryan special. Is this yours?
Security law? No, this is Division of Security, Banking Security.
That's a complicated.
It's
important. Important.
Let's go back up. Okay, we'll pick up House Bill 486. And witness from the department. Mr. Heller, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate the preparation on this. It was unfortunately coming a little late in the session, so give us your best shot.
There, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Terry Elder. I'm the Senior Securities Examiner with the Division of Banking Securities and Corporations in the Department of Commerce. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 486, which is an act to amend the Alaska Securities Act. And I'd like to thank the committee very much for its willingness to introduce this important piece of legislation, which we believe helps preserve significant state revenues while improving investor protection and providing new, easier access to capital markets for Alaska businesses. Why are we amending the Securities Act, and why is the bill so long? Well, we're amending the Securities Act for a number of reasons. First, Congress passed the National Securities Markets Improvement Act in 1996, and sometimes called NSMIA. And in that act, it created a new class of securities called federal covered securities, and a new type of investment advisor called federal covered advisors. NSMIA preempts states from requiring registration and collecting registration fees for these securities and advisors, but in order to be revenue neutral, roughly, they allow states to amend their statutes and regulations to require notice filings and notice fees. And that's what this legislation does. Alaska currently receives annual revenues from these sources in excess of $4 million. And these revenues have been growing at about a 14% rate over the last few years. At that rate, the revenues from these sources would roughly double in 5 years. So to preserve our revenues, we must amend our act to include these new types of securities and investment advisors and to provide for notice filings and notice fees. We must also amend our act to preserve the authority NSMIA gives to the states to continue to provide assistance to Alaska investors who complain about abusive sales practices by their investment advisors. If we do not amend our act, the general fund loses this revenue, and we lose the authority to enforce the anti-fraud provisions of the Securities Act with respect to federal covered advisors and their representatives. So that's why we're amending it. Why,
Mr. Stiller, who are those people? Are they investment banking account executives? Because they're federally licensed, but you can also regulate them here in the state. Is that?
Mr. Chairman, they're large investment advising firms that with NSMIA now only register with the SEC. In the past, they registered with both the SEC and the states.
Right.
With NSMIA, those large firms now only register with the SEC. However, NSMIA said that we can continue to require that they pay notice fees here, and we can continue to enforce the anti-fraud provisions of our act. So the SEC sees the states as the cop on the beat because we're closer to the investors, and if we don't do this, we don't have the authority to help investors here. We basically would have to tell them to call the SEC.
What's a big, or is there a threshold?
$25 million under management, roughly. It's more complicated than that, but that's essentially the threshold. So anything with $25 million or more under assets is a federal covered advisor.
So a large local investment advisor like McKinley Capital Management in Anchorage,
that's a federal,
it would be an SEC, but then what relations or what?
McKinley Capital is large enough, it will be a federal covered advisor, and therefore it's registered with the SEC.
And then what your department, what do they have to do with that company then, for example?
What does the SEC have to do with
it? No, you.
Us? Nothing except for enforcing anti-fraud provisions.
Okay.
So if they commit fraud, we could go after them. We don't anticipate that, of course, but I'm saying that that's what we could do.
What about
we have registered
security dealers and so forth?
Broker dealers are not affected in that way. We still register broker dealers, and we still have similar authority over broker dealers than we had before.
Without regard to capital size or anything?
That's correct.
There we go from a one-man shop to Merrill Lynch.
That's correct. NISMIA does affect some things about, for example, we can't any longer require different capital requirements or books and records requirements for broker dealers than is required by the SEC. So there are some changes like that, but in terms of general regulation of broker dealers, there's no change.
Please continue.
Thank you, sir. Then the next question is, why is the bill so long? First, NISMIA is the most significant change to federal securities laws in the last 50 years. It affects not only securities regulations by creating federal covered securities, but makes changes to the regulation of broker-dealers and especially to the regulation of investment advisors. This means that a lot of sections of our statute have to be changed to conform to the new regulatory regime. Our current statutes do not include notice filings and fees. They don't include federal covered securities, federal covered advisors, investment advisor representatives, state investment advisors, that the smaller ones that are no longer subject to SEC regulations at all, but only to those of the states, or prohibitions against specific unethical and fraudulent business practices, especially for investment advisors, which NISMIA provided was the proper domain for the states to enforce. So we have to make changes to accommodate all of those in our act. All of these require numerous changes and additions to the Securities Act, resulting in a long bill. Most of the language of these changes that are in this bill was drafted by the North American Securities Administrators Association, or NASA, N-A-S-A-A. And I call it, it's the NASA that doesn't go to the moon. It's an organization of securities administrators of which we belong. In all the 50 states, including Puerto Rico and D.C., all the provinces of Canada and Mexico. We also worked with industry, and we have received and given you in your packets copies of letters endorsing this legislation from the Investment Company Institute and the Investment Counsel Association of America, both associations that represent the major players that are affected by this legislation, mutual funds and investment counselors.
Excuse me. Have you had a chance to circulate this among the folks in the state that would be impacted by this yet?
Yes, sir. That in fact, was my next statement.
Sorry, please.
No, it's quite all right, Mr. Chairman. We provided drafts of our proposed changes to persons who requested them, mostly attorneys who are practicing in the field. We also participated in a continuing legal education seminar in October of 97 in Anchorage with the Alaska Bar Association. And we provided the Bar Association copies of a draft of the changes and solicited comments. So yes, we did share them with folks. In addition to the changes required by NISMIA, we are proposing new or updated language to other sections of the Securities Act, sometimes to modernize language and sometimes to improve access to capital markets for Alaska businesses. I'll give you a few examples of those. There's a new exemption from registration that's added for businesses that are seeking capital, but limiting their search to a select category of wealthy investors and institutions called accredited investors. It's called the accredited investor exemption. This will allow Alaska businesses to participate in new methods of raising capital, such as ACENET, that's the Angel Capital Electronic Network, which is a creation of the Small Business Administration. There's a new exemption added for businesses making their initial issuance of shares to the people forming the business and not to the general public. Some small businesses form and never intend to sell shares to the public. This exemption will remove the requirement for those people to file a request for exemption with the state. There's a new exemption added for the sellers of a business who transfer stock to the buyers of the business when the transfer is solely incidental to the sale of that business. That'll remove the potential liability that exists today when a small business owner sells his business to someone and neglects, when he transfers that stock because he had incorporated, neglects to either file a registration or exemption with the state. There's a new reciprocal limited registration created for Canadian broker-dealers to provide service to their existing clients who happen to be in Alaska for whatever reason, without having to be subject to the full examination and registration requirements of the Act. They are subject to the anti-fraud provisions of the Act. They cannot compete for new customers, but only service their existing Canadian customers who are in Alaska. It is reciprocal in that for a Canadian broker-dealer to be able to do this, that Canadian province must allow the same for a U.S. broker-dealer. These are probably the largest changes to the Act, so in the interest of the committee's time, I won't go into the other changes, but we'll refer you to the comments that we have provided on the sections of the bill, both for all the sections and specifically for the non-NISMIA sections of the bill. And when I conclude my remarks, obviously I'll be happy to answer any questions. But first, I would like to point out some corrections that are needed to the current draft of the bill as it is introduced. The division worked with legislative counsel in drafting the bill, and we appreciate their hard work and their careful work. They worked very diligently and in a detailed way. However, we didn't have a chance to proofread the bill before it was introduced, and so once it was and we proofread it, we did find some errors that need to be corrected. And we've given you a letter addressed to you, Mr. Chairman, dated April 16th, that lists 13 changes to the bill that are needed. The first 10 changes in that letter.
Where is it?
April 16th.
Is it in the book or?
No.
It's not in the book. It's not in this package.
It's right in the front of your bill in the back of this book. Just the very first thing, April 16th, 1998 letter.
That's a section.
Look under tab B.
Here, take that one.
About 20 pages in.
Tab D?
Tab E.
Maybe I didn't get one in your book.
Tab E?
About 20 pages in.
From tab E?
Yeah.
I got E, King Bay.
Yeah. I'm just guessing. I haven't counted
the sectional after the sectional?
Yeah, where's the, you got the bill?
Yeah.
If you get the bill and back up two pages, three pages. Four pages. Sorry.
I've got 18 pages of sectional. There you go. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, you have my copy.
Well, I have the staff, but everybody else has got one. I want to make sure.
I've got one.
Okay, except me. Okay, go ahead, sir.
Okay, thank you. The first 10 changes that are numbered are replacements for sections as they exist in the current draft of the bill. So it would be simply a matter of replacing the current sections with those that are in the letter. And the letter describes them, and I can go over them with you if you would like. Change number 11 in the letter is a new paragraph, which is added to the definition of investment advisor. This is a paragraph that I had discussed verbally with legislative counsel, and we had agreed to insert it, but somehow it got left out. This is the only correction that would add a new paragraph to the bill, and it would be on page 63. If adding a new paragraph to the bill would cause a logistical problem in moving the bill, then we can do without it, but if that wouldn't cause a problem, then this would be useful. The last two changes In the letter are changes to the dates. When I was speaking with Legislative Council, they told me that they were going to put in a November 1, 1998 effective date, and I noticed that it's November 1, 1999, which unfortunately would cause us to lose our authority to collect notice fees and require notices. So in order to avoid that, we would need to have a change to 1998.
Excuse me, Mr. Elder, is there anything in here that would preclude you from drafting regulations prior to their effective dates? We went through this with another bill this year where we were concerned that because the effective date in certain sections were out some time, that without those sections being adopted, they didn't have authority to do the regs until they were at that effective date.
Mr. Chairman, my reading of this allows us to go out and draft the regulations, but they wouldn't take effect until November 1, 1999. But
the authority is in specific language in the bill?
Yes, in the last page of the bill, it has section 78. It says, notwithstanding section 82, the Department of Commerce may immediately proceed to adopt regulations necessary to implement the changes, and the regulations take effect, but not before November 1, 1999. And so we could do that. I'm simply saying that would be too late.
Try to do that.
Because the...
Yeah, we've run into that problem before, yeah. Particularly on large things like that where there is prospective future date.
And actually, as I said, in speaking with Legislative Council, they had said November 1, 1998, so I suspect that that's a mistake, and that's why I suggest changing that to 98.
Okay.
With that, Mr. Chairman, I've concluded my prepared remarks. I'll certainly be happy to answer any questions that you might have for the committee.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, because of my extreme confidence in Mr. Willis Kirkpatrick and also Mr. Elder, whom I've known for quite a number of years to be almost a perfectionist, I would like to see how comfortable you would be with tabbing amendments number 1 through 10 as amendment number 1.
Not a problem.
And, Mr. Chairman, I would move amendment number 1.
Are there any objections? Hearing none. Amendment number 1 is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I would move amendment number 11 in the April 16th letter as amendment number 2, because it is the a complete sectional addition to the bill, and I would move that as amendment number 2 and ask consent of the committee.
I'll let Jeff for just could you explain, Mr. Elder, what that new section 75 is going to be doing?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. NISMIA, the SEC is given the authority to define investment advisor representative. And so we have crafted the definition in our act according to the definition that the SEC has already come up with. What this would allow, because it's brand new and the SEC just did it, nobody ever had definitions of investment advisor representative before, and there could be some changes, especially early on in the first few years. What this paragraph would do would allow us to automatically track with the SEC. If the SEC deletes somebody from the definition of investment advisor, then the person would be automatically deleted from our definition as well. And we wouldn't have to come back and either ask for an amendment or issue an order changing it. It would be a little tough if it were in our statute saying somebody is when in fact they aren't. So this would be a way to automatically track what the SEC is, since we can't differ between what the SEC says is an investment advisor rep anyway.
What is an investment advisor representative?
Essentially, investment advisor representative is an agent of an investment advisor, whether it's a state investment advisor or a federal covered advisor. Just like when you walk into a broker dealer, the person you're sitting there talking to at the desk who's talking to you about buying and selling stocks is an agent of that broker dealer. Well, the person that's actually giving the investment advice representing that investment advisor is called an investment advisor representative.
Where's that line demarked between, and do they have to be an employee and advisor with a registered corporation, or do they and additionally be licensed themselves?
Mr. Chairman, they would have to be a supervised person of an investment advisor, so by definition. So they would either be a representative of a state investment advisor that is registered with the state, or a federal covered advisor that is registered with the SEC and noticed with the state.
And they are advising in the actual acquisition and sales and purchasing of securities.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, they are giving the advice.
They're not a what's known as a financial planner or financial advisor. That's a distinction that's made. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. If a financial planner does not give investment advice and does not receive income for that advice separate from financial planning, then that's correct or not.
But if a that would be a no-fee financial planner, a fee-fetched financial planner, a no-fee financial planner many times gets their compensation from fees provided by security companies when they recommend securities. So would they be covered under this?
Mr. Chairman, if that person gives investment advice and with respect to allocation of assets and specific securities,
recommending a mutual fund purchase, for example.
Yes, that would be giving investment advice, and they would have to be a registered investment advisor representative. Yes, sir.
Representative Ryan.
I have a friend whose father is a very good, gives some very good tips. Is he going to have to become licensed under this, or only if he holds out for a fee?
If he holds himself out to the public.
I wouldn't want to lose that source.
Absolutely.
Yeah, same distinction we made in real estate. You can do it if you don't make money out of it.
Yes.
Is there, there seems to be, does the state of Alaska or your division have any particular regulatory authority over this area called financial planning, unless they are under your investment advisor representative definition?
Mr. Chairman, the answer to that is no. If
it's not normal, but I was wondering, because it's a growing industry, and there can be, I think, there's very little regulation, definition, educational requirements, and so forth and so on. There's national organizations that are somewhat self-policing, but there seems to be little state or federal regulation of their activities.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. And what we do is in here is simply add some language to make it real clear to people who are in that business that if you're giving investment advice, then you're covered. You're an investment advisor representative. If you're not, then you're not.
Say there were a fee financial planner did not get compensated by the mutual fund company, but they received fees from their clients who they were advising, would they still be covered under your definition?
Mr. Chairman, it depends on what kind of advice they're giving. If they're giving financial planning type of advice about planning for your kids' future, planning for insurance provisions and that sort of thing, then they would not be covered as an investment advisor representative. But if they sit down with you and say you should have a more equity exposure, and here are some mutual funds that would fit your objectives, that's investment advice.
Further questions on this amendment? If not, is there any objections on? I removed my objection on the amendment, the motion to move amendment number 2, which is item 11, section 75. Hearing none, it's so adopted. Representative Hudson.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that sections 12 and 13 of the April 16th letter be construed as amendment number 3 for purposes of this discussion. And both of them are essentially changing the date from 1999 to November 1, 1998. And I think we've heard the agency talk about it, and I would move section 12 and 13 then as amendment number 3 and ask committee's consent.
Second.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, so moved. Before we go, there's Representative Ryan has provided the committee with an amendment. Mr. Elder, have you seen the amendment from Representative Ryan?
Mr. Chairman, I saw it shortly before the session here. Committee staff shared it with me.
It's not the intention of the chair to move this bill today. It's the intention to move it first thing Monday. Would you like to have some more time to look this over, or are you comfortable with this, or do you care to comment on it at this time?
I could comment on it at this time.
Why don't you go ahead and make some comments?
Sure. The change that this would make to which is a new exemption that we proposed, B5C, and this would change that. It wouldn't affect the people that we had in mind for B5C. It would broaden it, but it wouldn't affect it. The people that we had in mind specifically for the B5C exemption was people who are incorporating their businesses and they're issuing the initial shares to themselves and not to the general public, and that's what we had in mind. This still deals specifically with the initial issuance, and although there's two primary differences that I can see. One is that it expands. We have corporations and limited liability companies. This adds limited partnerships and limited liability partnerships. I don't think that's a problem. The other thing it does is remove a reference to a requirement that it be that the entity be organized in the state of Alaska. I don't think that's a problem. The third thing it does is it removes the requirement that these people that the 10 or fewer persons we're talking about be promoters as defined by regulation, and promoters are that currently defined in regulation essentially as people who directly or indirectly are take an active role in forming the company. Since this exemption is still limited to the initial issue of shares, presumably all of those people probably are involved in the formation of the entity, and so that probably also is not a problem. We would, on that basis, while it's not our proposal, and therefore we're not recommending it, we won't oppose it either.
Representative Ryan.
Well, it's my amendment. I think perhaps I can explain why I offered it. Last year, I submitted a bill since the IRS restrictions on limited liability companies with the five criteria you had to meet depending on whether you're going to be treated for taxation as a corporation or you could have pass-through taxation were repealed by the IRS. And so we updated the Limited Liability Company Act to reflect that IRS update, which makes it very easy to form. And so far, Alaska is the only state that's done that. So we have got a maintenance rule of business with the exception of this sticky point registering these fully owned companies are getting the exemption. Now, the agency or the department's been issuing a letter saying that, yeah, these aren't securities at such. And this has been the fly in the ointment for people who want to use these in the formations of trust and a number of other things throughout the world, not just in Alaska. Alaska has this new updated limited liability company law. And have these limited liability companies formed for various purposes they want to outside of Alaska, and there's no registration in other states, but Alaska had this thing, so we're putting this amendment here to clean that up so that this will be open and that we can take advantage of that act and we can do the business we want to do. There was a very large company going to be $1 million worth of assets, and because of the sticky provision, they don't have to register in Florida, and they didn't want to register here, so the deal went sour. We stand to make a lot of money. That's part of what this whole business is doing with trust and limited liabilities and companies and so forth. I'd like to have Alaska as a notice as an estate planning venue, and this amendment would facilitate that. That's why it was offered.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could add to that, in fact, that simply because a security is exempt from registration does not mean it's exempt from the anti-fraud provision. So if in fact there were a problem with an abuse of some type, then we would have authority to go after the issuer.
Go ahead.
If I could offer that as number four, I'd appreciate it. That does seem to be a judgment from the department. I think you'll find an accompanying letter from Richard Hombe that explains why we want to do this.
Accompanying letter?
We have this letter from Richard Hombe and Associates.
Bill, I haven't seen that. Just tell that this by deleting this the term promoter, does that cause any heartburn? Because is there other purposes for having that term in regulation?
Mr. Chairman, as I said, the reason that we had added promoter was simply that what we had in mind was to provide an exemption for people who are forming their own companies and issuing stock to themselves and not to the general public, and why make them go through a filing with the state? We see this a lot. For example, if a fisher person in Petersburg is decided to incorporate, and therefore he and his wife own the business, and they incorporate and they put the assets of the fishing business into the corporation and issue stock to themselves, they have to now write a letter to the state, and we have to either have an exemption or write them a letter saying we won't take action against them. And so we thought that we would simply provide an automatic mechanism for folks like that to be covered, so they didn't have to do that. And so that, and because those are people who are forming the company, by they fit the definition of promoter, and so that's why we had promoter in there. In particular, to distinguish them from passive investors. In other words, you could have, we were saying a promoter is someone who is actively involved in the formation of the company. And therefore knows about the company. You'll notice there's no disclosure requirement and things like that in there, because presumably you're forming the company, you have the information you need about it. You're not a passive investor, and that's why we have that in there.
Chairman,
Representative,
you put a corporation together, you'll notice that you send Mr. Patrick a letter along with a $40 fee telling him that the stocks aren't going to be publicly traded and they're exempt from SEC requirements. It's a nice modicum for the state for that little letter, and it, $40. I've done it a few times. I know how it worked.
Well, yeah, I haven't seen this letter, and the department hasn't seen the letter, and Mr. Hompesh, which I respect, but he says that the division is gutting the benefit of the new law by narrowly defining promoter. I'm not sure what that all means. I mean, I don't think we're going to have any trouble with this, but I certainly would like to have them have a chance to look at this. Would you have any objection to that? Or
with this back? From Richard
No, Mr. Chairman, I haven't seen the letter.
Sorry, I thought my staff's got that.
For Mr. Hompesh.
We did not have a copy of this either with any explanation, which may well provide us.
Can we make copies right now?
Yeah, it would be good for the whole. Do you mind?
Sure.
Is this the.
Okay.
Because my intention here would be to try to review it to make sure and give everybody a chance to read this bill and take it up first thing and move it on Monday. And then we'd if the department wants to look at that, and if there's any other amendments, we'll take them up and blow them out of here.
I'm just asking. I didn't have any objection to my amendment. Do you?
Well, that's why I brought it up, to see if they did, you know. Yeah. So.
Well, right. Until Monday, or we can do it today.
Yeah, why don't we wait? Did you want a chance to look at that, or?
Well, Mr. Chairman, like
I'm concerned about what it does to limited partnerships, and then what is a limited liability partnership? Do we create that with the bill last year, Joe? What was
That's a relatively new entity that's been created.
Was that in the bill that we just did? Bill last year, or what was that?
Gene Terrio, I think, a couple years ago.
Limited liability partnership.
That's a fairly new entity, Mr. Chairman. We're simply adding it because it is a new entity that didn't exist when the Securities Act was passed. So that and limited liability company.
Well, it's not in your clause here, but it's in Representative Ryan.
That's correct. And I said that doesn't that by itself does not present a problem.
Well, what about limited partnerships now? Is there restrictions that relate to the 10 or under and how you handle those limited partnerships because they're brought into this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, again, no. Limited partnerships would not create a problem. The expansion from corporations and limited liability companies to include limited partnerships and limited liability partnerships would not present a problem.
Because of the numbers of people?
Because the numbers of people and because this is limited to the initial issuance.
Refresh my memory on the state in terms of limited partnerships. What's the threshold there when you get, how many, is it over 10 people, then you have to be registered or what? What are the dollar amount?
Mr. Chairman, that's not my area, Mr. Chairman. I don't know.
Different area.
Basically, limiting the liability of the partners. Previous in a partnership, everybody is rating several. You owe whatever your partner runs up. In a limited partnership, you have.
I know that, but I'm wondering what the restrictions are in the balance of the laws related to limited partnership because they're not spoken to in this section. So,
Mr. Chairman, perhaps
sure.
I can help.
Sure.
For the record, I'm Vince Usera with the Department of Law.
Yes, sir.
The limitation there is 10 investors, no more than 10 investors, and $500,000.
On limited partnerships?
For a limited partnership that doesn't have to go through registration.
Okay, so there's another requirement relating to the dollar amount then.
Initial capitalization.
Right. Would that have any bearing on this by adding that or not? Joe, do you think it'd have any bearing?
The flexibility of limited liability companies, limited partnerships are the reason for passing this law.
Mr. Sir, did you have a copy of this?
I read it prior to the meeting.
Do you have any comments on it?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I guess as I said, I don't think our position on it would change between now and Monday. I think while we had something specific in mind when we added the B5C exemption, I don't think we'd have any objection to this. We're not recommending it, but we don't have any objection to it. And so our major concern is because of the time available to the rest of the session is to get the bill through as expeditiously as we can.
Well, yeah, I'm going to move. We're going to have the votes. Everybody's here, and we're going to hit this bolt of lightning. We're going to move it Monday, if that helps. And I was just wondering about Mr. Hobbit's letter. Says you narrowly defined promoter.
No, that
one day. I think that's strange because you just allow yourself to define what promoter is by regulation in the future. I don't know how narrow that is.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I've never heard anybody. First of all, I've never talked to Mr. Hombich about it, and secondly, I've never had anybody tell me we defined promoter too narrowly. That is defined in regulation. We will be redoing our regulations as a result of this legislation, and so consequently, anyone who thinks we're too narrowly defining promoter, or anything else for that matter, will have an ample opportunity to make those recommendations to us.
Well, this promoter used elsewhere in this bill, so this removal doesn't damage your ability to define that.
It's used elsewhere, Mr. Chairman, so no, it does not.
This is not a negative.
It would not hurt our ability to use it.
So what do you want to do?
Hold the amendment. Number 4, I think.
Okay.
About 20 minutes ago.
Is there a motion on the floor?
I move this amendment I have submitted as amendment number 4. Page 44, lines 4 to 12, delete all material and insert. I'm going to read the amendment.
No, we have it in our hand. Are there any objections to this amendment? Hearing none, so move to adopt it.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask Mr. Elder about this letter from Dave Shaftel with a proposed amendment.
Could you speak up a little bit? I mean, I have trouble hearing you.
I'd like to ask Mr. Elder about this letter from Dave Shaftel. Have you received this? Dated, the facts, excuse me. April 23rd. He has a proposed amendment to the bill. I just saw it in my packet. I don't know.
And that's to for family transactions?
Yeah. Degree of affinity or consanguinity, plan and option.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ryan, yes, I have seen that. That's the amendment that I was aware of before I came to the meeting.
What is your opinion? Did you like that? Is that
No, actually, that I don't have any problem at all. The department wouldn't have any problem at all with that amendment. Currently,
excuse me, yes, the committee is not privy to this amendment or communication. We don't have that.
It's not
in the general distribution.
I don't know where it showed up in my file. I assumed everybody else had it. Here, I'd be happy to give it to you.
Let's see here. Dave Shaftel to Terry Elder. Does this look familiar? Let's take a brief edit.